Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm a health, food, and environmental journalist. I'm with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. And every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and your total health environment. And that means the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the health of the global ecology. We're expanding the notion of what we call our health, from personal health concerns to collective, societal, global ones. And every week on the show, I talk to different experts, authors, advocates, scientists, and thought leaders about different aspects of connecting the dots to our total health environment. Today's show, you can also find my blogs on the Huffington Post and Alternet. I have one up right now on Alternet. Wonderful interview with Wilma Subra, who for 25 years has tracked the impacts of toxic chemical spills and contamination to major communities and the impact on public health following Hurricane Katrina, the Gulf oil spill, and she's now looking into fracking and its infrastructures as it spreads nationwide. So you can find that blog on Alternet. It's up and live this week. On today's show, I'm delighted to have a wonderful guest who is really thinking about the solution side of some of the problems that I cover a great deal on this show, which is, you know, kind of the way that industry, technology, and the economics and the governance of the corruption of the governance of our society wind up harming our health and the health of the earth and the you know, the kind of natural parts of the earth, the food and everything that we need to live, as well as other species. And so today we're going to talk to David Bollier, who's really been a thought leader in developing something that we all share but don't think about, which is an important way to understand and revision how we can solve some of the collective issues and concerns that I regularly cover on the show. His latest book is called Think Like a Commoner, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. He's an author, activist, blogger, and consultant who has been looking at a new paradigm of economics, politics, culture for over a decade. He works with a lot of really fascinating groups. He was a founding editor of onthecommons.org, and he's co-authored or co-edited or written 12 different books. He has another current book up right now, which I don't have, but it's also a very recent book with a very interesting title. It's called Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Commons. So today we're going to learn a lot about the commons and a whole different way of thinking, valuing, and conceiving solutions from David Bollier. Welcome, David, to Connect the Dots.
It's terrific to be here.
So, you know, I think, like myself, I'm really a newbie to this entire topic. I've kind of heard it, talked about, and encountered it in passing for a number of years, and I think many of my listeners may be in the same boat. Your book is a fantastic introduction. Can you introduce our listeners now to, you know, some basic ideas? What are we talking about? What is the commons, and why do we need to think like a commoner?
Well, I think that the simplest way to understand the commons is those things that we share and have an obligation to protect and pass on to the next generation. Mm-hmm. And many of these things are invisible because we don't, to the extent that we're focused on the market or government as the only solutions to things, we don't think about the value of the atmosphere, federal research, the internet, the oceans, all the our cultural inheritance, scientific research, and the rest. Well, these are kind of common assets that don't have a price tag, yet they're indispensable to our daily lives. So there's a lot of shared assets. But another way of looking at the commons is as a invisible economy of sharing and collaboration and cooperation that gets things done. Academic disciplines are our commons. There's all sorts of seed sharing that goes on as an alternative to conventional markets in developing the developing world. An estimated 2 billion people in the world live off of commons from forest fisheries, irrigation water, wild game, and the rest. And it's basically not recognized by economists because there's no market activity going on, there's no prices, and therefore it's seen as not valuable. But of course, lots of needs are being met, basic needs are being met, without the market or government being involved. And much of my work is involved in showing how commons can provide all sorts of needs, meet lots of our needs, without the kind of predatory markets or bureaucratic structures that conventional politics seems to think we need. And in fact, there's a burgeoning international movement going on, especially in Europe and the Global South, devoted to trying to reclaim the commons, which means we have access to things we need, we have less inequality, we have more self-determination over basic resources.
Mm-hmm. In terms of, I think what happens, I mean, I am speaking to you from New York City, you know, and I think what I perceive, you know, among the people that I exchange with and all, and my wide network on, globally, nationally, and globally through the Internet, for example, which is another commons that I hope we'll be talking about during the show, you know, is that people who, you know, live in a rural setting where they can grow their own food, and they can, you know, barter with neighbors. You know, I grew the turnips, you grew the zucchini, or you know, whatever. There are ways for trades and things to happen in a more traditional sense. In cities, we may recycle our, you know, some of our belongings or purchases or donate them or give them, but it's harder to see what from within, you know, the heart of the beast or the bowels of the beast in an urban environment. You know, even though we're, of course, benefiting from food that comes in from other areas and that comes in from land and the air quality and all of that, how people can escape, you know, or function and get their needs met beyond the economic bureaucratic structures to which you refer.
Uh-huh. Well,
ideas about that?
Mm-hmm. You're right in especially in advanced industrial societies, although I might put a quotation mark around advanced. Mm-hmm. The market and the state have sort of taken up most of those spaces. But let me just tell a short little parable about New York City. About 20 or 30 years ago, there were a lot of abandoned lots, which were a blight for the neighborhoods, but people started to grow their own community gardens on them. They turned them into these really green oases in the city, all by themselves without anybody looking. And lo and behold, property values started to raise in the adjacent blocks of those areas. And then Mayor Giuliani said, let's turn those community gardens into condos and build on them. Well, it was an example of how the self-organized commons devised by people themselves created important value for a community in the heart of a market, of market culture, New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a parable for how the commons works, and we've seen it, you mentioned the internet. The internet is a vast hosting infrastructure for commons, which has created everything from open source software to Wikipedia to open access scientific journals. It goes on and on. And it's an example of how people coming together to cooperate can create all sorts of value despite there being this market apparatus that is trying to capture that value.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting tension, you know, that exists. You know, one of the things that has occurred to me coming from the, you know, the publishing world and the media and all of that is that, you know, through purchasing an author's books, through giving someone medical authority, entrusting their opinion, through aggregating around certain individuals, we sort of empower those individuals or that medical authority or that book or that publisher, you know, and we see ourselves as kind of beggars who are, you know, kind of getting something we need, whether it's health advice or something else in you know, along those lines. But in fact, we're also building the the authorities and the structures in which we invest, you know, our money through purchasing a book or purchasing any kind of product or activity, as well as our trust and belief that this is the way, you know, to get our needs met. And what you're proposing is a different way, really, of thinking about getting our needs met. Can you talk a little bit a radically different way?
You really hit it on the head in that there's all sorts of ways to for people to take control without the government having to sanction it or without having to have a market apparatus of contracts and money exchange and lawyers and so forth involved. And I think I will just reference the Internet because that's maybe one of the purest examples because there's less physical infrastructure involved. You just it's very low barrier to access. But we can see it in the local food movements where people are starting to take control over how they achieve how they obtain their food and know who is producing it under what conditions. So we see the community-supported agriculture and permaculture and the so-called slow food movement. I mentioned seed sharing. This is an example of taking control over resources that matter to us and doing it in a way that's accountable to the community. Mm-hmm. And localism is sort of burgeoning with the commons in things like alternative currencies, community currencies. In Western Massachusetts, they have Berkshires, for example. And this is an example of trying to develop a parallel economy that's not as subservient to the bank and debt-driven economy. So
they actually come up with their own currency, their own money?
Yes. In Western Massachusetts, the E.F. Schumacher Foundation is the host of Berkshires, and it's a quite widely used complementary currency in the region there. But internationally as well, there are really dozens of such currencies. And there's, of course, Bitcoin has popularized the new types of digital cryptocurrencies, and that's going to be an emerging type of system for people to retain greater control over the value they create as opposed to banks and other centralized financial institutions being able to capture it all.
Could you tell us a little bit about Bitcoin?
Well, Bitcoin has been in the news a lot lately, chiefly because it's been an object of so much speculative investment. And therefore it's not quite as developed as a medium of exchange for purchasing things. But nonetheless, it's an important proof of concept that a digital currency can be used by a community that's trustworthy, not counterfeitable, not going to be inflated in value the way government often does. And there are a number of other currencies that are trying to step into the limelight as useful alternatives to conventional so-called fiat currencies issued by national governments. And what this will allow is for communities to sort of capture the value created by their members as opposed to banks as holders of debt being able to capture all that value for their investors and for hedge funds and so forth. So it's really an interesting example, a new frontier really, of how new types of commons could take control over things. In other words, instead of it being siphoned into capital, there can be commons accumulation where the community can retain control, much as Linux, the open source operating system, has retained control of the innovation and value it's created over the years.
So people can learn more about this, I'm guessing, on your website, because, you know, I mean, do you know people who are, you know, using, I mean, it really is a bit, you know, who instead of using a PC or a Mac or whatever, are using Linux?
Well, Linux is an operating system similar to that it competes essentially with Windows and the Mac operating system, and it's no cost and freely modifiable, unlike those systems, and it's really probably the largest open source project. But there are really hundreds of open source software programs that cannot be taken private, or captured by proprietary interests. And that's what really makes them so attractive to people, because they can be modified and changed and evolved according to user interests and needs, as opposed to the business model of the company that makes them.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. You know, let's talk a little bit about the internet as a commons. I'm very active on Facebook. Know many people who are. And you know, Facebook, I think, has been an amazing introduction for you know, people unfamiliar with this kind of mode of going at things that you're describing, to connect with other people, to connect with people you might never have met before, to engage in group kind of sharing and thinking and mulling over certain topics, a whole bunch of different things. So I think on the one hand it really has introduced people to a certain kind of potential, and yet at the same time it's occurring within, you know, a parameter of the ownership of Facebook. These folks can change the privacy rules, change the layout, you know, change all kinds of things at their will, and there isn't, you know, participants don't have any say in the matter. So I think it's an interesting, you know, kind of transitional space for looking at these issues in terms of, you know, both the potential of the commons and what is and isn't, you know, the up and down sides of something that really isn't, that, you know, kind of gives, feels like a commons, but is in fact owned in a certain kind of way.
You've described it well. I've heard such things as Facebook described as a digital plantation, where we work on the corporate plantation and they capture all the value. And in some ways it's kind of a faux or phony commons, because there is indeed sharing and cooperation, but it's on the terms dictated by the hosting platform, be it Facebook, Twitter, or whomever. But, and so I think you're right that there is going to be a social and technical backlash to Facebook-type models, and I think we're on the verge of that, because people are really getting tired of having their privacy violated and being over-advertised to, and essentially their business model is based on exploiting and pissing off their users. So I think that we're ripe for a commons-based alternative that's user-controlled. Getting there in the face of a very wealthy, technologically sophisticated proprietary platform is really a major challenge. So that could take some work.
So there isn't, you know, an open source Facebook waiting for us all.
Well, there have been attempts to do it, and there are some interesting platforms that would allow people to, instead of having all of your information shared with, you know, 500 people, being able to self-select your own community of friends or network that's more selective and even variable from one community to the next. But those haven't really achieved a scale yet, and I think partly it's having the technical infrastructure to do that is a major challenge, and, you know, without significant capital, it can take some time to do.
So that's, you know, so we're back in that conundrum of, you know, how do we affect the change and head out the door and all of that. What about in terms, let's talk a little bit about finances. One of the questions that, or one of the things we've covered on this show, I've had Bill McKibben and other people from 350.org on the program, and one of the things they're urging is the divestment from gas and oil companies. I've covered, you know, this is the fossil fuel extraction and use is driving, accelerating climate change. I've covered fracking a great deal and broke the story on that. You know, so they're urging divestment, but one of the, questions I think that arises, for people who are bought into the stock market is, you know, what do you then invest in? Of course, you know, from the green or, you know, environmental perspective, the answer would be renewable energy. But I you know, but you might have a different answer. So, you know, of moving, because, you know, you speak of giving value to the banks and all of that, you know, like our investments are really investing in a lot of companies and infrastructures that we may not want to be giving value to. That's just one example. You know, I would certainly consider pharmaceutical companies another example, having covered integrative medicine for a couple of decades. So, you know, can you give some thoughts to people about that? Because I think what happens, too, is that people, you know, kind of get to a thing where, you know, in for an inch, in for a mile kind of thing. So any ideas about different ways to invest? Because when you're speaking of developing, you know, a better more shared and cooperative internet meeting common ground, like, you know, akin to Facebook, you know, there are economic barriers. So, you know, I'd love to hear you speak a bit about investment from the perspective of the commons.
Well, I think that many of these issues are not going to be achieved by individual investment changes, although certainly we can start to steer them in better direction. I think infrastructure, we need to imagine infrastructure being structured in different ways so that renewable energy could be become more decentralized instead of centrally controlled and consolidated the way the fossil fuel industry is. Mm-hmm. So, for example, smart grids have been suggested as a way to allow people to have their own renewable energy sources in localities or even neighborhoods or individual homes, and that can feed into the grid and help relieve the burden of centralized energy sources like nuclear power or fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So that's an infrastructure example. But you mentioned other ways that we can channel investment. I think the cooperative movement has enormous potential for being more socially constructive than Wall Street. And again, it's more locally and regionally responsive than those kinds of institutions. And I think in Europe, there's a whole so-called social banking movement where banks can serve communities and social goals more frontally and legally as opposed to just maximizing shareholder value the way conventional banks do. So I think that these are the kinds of institutions we need to start to develop more. But, you know, that takes a lot of, sometimes will take policy work. You know, I think of how we almost had a consumer cooperative bank in the late 70s, which was defeated by corporate America because they didn't want the competition from alternative financing vehicles like a cooperative bank. But I think we're at a time now where we've seen enough of the predation and failures of conventional banks that we need to start to experiment the way a lot of states are doing with state banks. North Dakota famously has this public bank that helps provide small businesses and students and others with lower interest loans than they can get from conventional banks. So these are the kinds of innovations I think we need to explore more of.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about, I'm just going to sort of throw a little kind of case story at you and hear your comments. This is something I've covered on the show a great deal, which is, you know, the problem with fracking. You know, what happens is that I remember when I first began looking into fracking and then covering it back in around 2008, the New York Times was at that time covering it as, oh, well, you know, this is just a fight between neighbors. One neighbor wants the right to, and, you know, and has the right as a private individual to frack their land. And I've heard that same statement or sentiment, you know, stated over and over and over again in the whole debate about fracking. And yet, you know, one neighbor has the right to frack their land, but then, you know, the leaking contaminants into the air and the water and food supply of the neighbor and surrounding region has the other neighbor saying, you know, no, I don't want this activity. And it just becomes a kind of ugly tug of war between one person's conception of their rights and the other person's conception of their rights, and then of course you have a gas company with its, you know, so-called rights, or, you know, its business drivers, and in some states, for example, in New York, they can actually force people to comply and participate in gas extraction or put pipelines through their property without permission. You know, how would you analyze that particular national problem and debate that's going on right now in terms of your of the commons?
Well, that was the story you've sketched really is sort of a case study of the fictions of market economics and policy, which presumes that my property can be wholly divorced and separated from yours and from the ecosystem, when in fact we're tied together with these interdependencies and flows between us and nature. And that's partly the one of our problems, is that the private property system and market economics doesn't acknowledge the realities of ecological flows and dependencies and interrelationships. And therefore, we have these really ridiculous fictions and presumptions that we can be totally isolated from each other and from the land. So the commons perspective takes that as a starting point, that we're interconnected and we need to develop shared ways of responsible ways of sharing resources and being stewards of them, not just being owners of them in the sense that I'll do whatever the hell I want with what is mine, because what is mine is really it blurs quite readily into the rest of the world and to our neighbors. So I think the commons perspective is a way to start to develop a different way of seeing the world, but also a different way of governing resources than conventional politics and governance does, and certainly more than in a different way than conventional markets govern the world.
So how would, you know, give us a, you know, kind of for instance of how the understanding of commons and the solutions that arise from that would be, you know, could be brought to bear on that kind of situation?
Well, I think for one thing, you would have greater local self-determination of what should be exploitable or not, instead of perhaps bureaucrats in Washington or absentee investors who don't care anything about your locality being able to just rip and run. That's really the biggest scandal, is that these, what economists will primly call externalities, meaning pollution and other disruptions, they're able to impose those externalities on all sorts of people who happen to live there. So I know there's a group, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund in Pennsylvania, that is very active in devising legal strategies for communities to have greater self-control over their own economic circumstances as well as their local ecosystems. So I think that's a beginning place to protect one's local environment and not have just such enormous centralized and, I might add, corruptible power from national and market authorities. So it gives us a way to imagine different ways of governance. But we're at a very early stage as well. But let's just say that many of the traditional paths of reform through Congress or the regulatory process are really just proving themselves to be corrupt or ineffectual. And so we need to start a new, start with a new orientation and start to innovate new types of governance structures.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. We're coming upon the break time for station identification at the halfway point of the program, and actually I'd love to take that up with you further and explore it further in the second half of the show, because, you know, a lot of the expected solutions or assumptions that the public makes is that either something is safe because it's already being regulated for safety, or, and, you know, I'm not certainly carrying that notion, but as a reporter and journalist reporting on a wide range of health-harming and environmentally destructive industrial practices, you know, one looks to regulation to kind of control these. And so if it isn't there right now, the presumption is we as citizens could potentially get it. But that comes hard, too. So I'd like to talk with you more about that in the second half of the show. Stay with us, listeners. We're taking a short break for station identification. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're talking today on Connect the Dots with David Bollier, the author of Think Like a Commoner. Please stay with us for the second half of the show. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and today we're talking with David Bollier, the author of Think Like a Commoner, a short introduction to the life of the commons. And I just want to say a few things. If you are just tuning in for the second half of the show, you'll be able to find the complete show later in the Connect the Dots archive, so you can hear the first half of the show as well. And if you are staying with the show and have been listening to it and enjoy it, please pass it along to others who may be interested in this topic, as well as like us on iTunes. You can find the book, Think Like a Commoner, as well as a whole lot of informations, essays, podcasts, blogs, and other books of David Bollier's and other people's on this important topic on his website, bollier.org. BOLLIER.org. So just want to make sure that people who are, whose interest is piqued by this conversation of the commons with someone who has really, been an activist and author and thought deeply about it, wanted to make sure you could get more information. The book is, wonderful, and there are, endorsements by Ralph Nader and Bill McKibben, and Maud Barlow, among others, on the back cover. At the end of the second half of the show, David, we were talking about, you know, our hopes that national regulation, you know, of one kind or another, you know, some people imagine it's still there and are still kind of catching up to the idea that we're doing all these difficult things. Others are trying to sway government in a better direction, get better regulation, get better elected officials, you know, go after things like Citizen United that makes that, you know, an ever-increasing challenge. Would love to hear your thoughts. You know, it seems like when we organize commons and talk about it, it often sounds as if it's both, you know, local in some kind of way in you know, someone's community such as yours in Western Mass, or global. But, you know, what about the national level that we need to grapple with, and what is a commons approach or a realistic assessment of what we have going on there?
Well, in many ways, government is trying to be a surrogate for the commons. I often refer to them as state trustee commons, meaning that they manage the national parks or public lands and things like that, that they're acting as a trustee for the public and the commons. People tend to forget that and often think that government owns that, but in fact, government owes an obligation to us, the people, not to oil leasers or cattle ranchers for that property. Mm-hmm. But to your point, certain resources are so big that they clearly need some sort of government role, or regulation is important. But I think that what has to happen is regulation needs to become more transparent and participatory than it's become. Because right now it's been so captured by lawyers, lobbyists, and big money that the public is essentially frozen out on all sorts of issues, can't participate or isn't respected because they're just ordinary people and not so-called highly paid expert. So some examples of that, I think in the news right now is this General Motors recall of cars. Well, it turns out that the database for a lot of car accidents and fatalities is not really readily searchable or even available to the public. Why not make that more open and available? some people have proposed that financial data reported to the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, be essentially made open source and available to anyone to slice and dice. And that would be very helpful for people independently to say, you know what, there's a financial trouble over here, let's go after it, as opposed to waiting for SEC bureaucrats, some of whom may be politically influenced, to take action.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ways to make the process more participatory. I know, for example, in environmental protection, there's all sorts of wiki-like participatory projects where people can report bird counts or butterfly counts in their area, or water quality or air quality. Well, why can't the EPA host those kinds of things and get citizens involved in monitoring environmental quality, being first frontline eyes and ears, in a sense, which would not only bring more people to support environmental regulation, but help them begin to take a little more active involvement locally or regionally. This is the kind of, I think, reform of the regulatory process that could really could help make it more effective and less corruptible than it's been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, going back yet again to the fracking example, you know, we have proprietary chemicals. So instead of releasing information about what these contaminants are, and again, this is the subject of my current blog, you know, when contamination hits communities, the entire gas industry and fracking process has been exempt from any reporting requirements. So you're saying that in addition to regulating, just even getting information, and I think that's also behind the move to label foods that contain GMOs. You know, it's actually the right to information, and then people can act accordingly or protect themselves. And so that's a front upon which to act.
Yeah, I think strategically mm-hmm. what's important is to begin to open up these different fronts. Instead of the food industry going to the USDA to say, fix it all, people said, we're going to create our own food system. That shifted the center of gravity socially and politically and created a sort of solid constituency base who then could later go to the USDA and say, this is what we want for organic food standards or labeling, and have much more power, as opposed to just being individual naked citizens approaching government and not really having the power.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I see the Commons as helping to bring together like-minded people in a way that doesn't focus exclusively or necessarily even primarily on policy or government, except when it's absolutely necessary and important.
Mhm. 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 Yeah, that's really that makes a lot of sense. I think about it in terms of health too, because we have a healthcare system that offers extreme and costly interventions for late stage health problems, rather than offering proactive things that people can easily do, or through roping in some of the harmful things in the environment, because, you know, you can choose to eat healthy food if healthy food is available. But if we allow, for example, you know, the food industry to advertise to young people to, if they get subsidies for cheap foods, if they design their foods to be addictive, to then make it a matter of individual choice that you can, you know, if you become overweight or obese due to eating these foods, that, you know, it's up to you to change your diet or not participate, and many people don't have the financial wherewithal or the availability of better food, or, you know, the willpower to do it, and then they create a health burden. What would be the common solution to that kind of problem?
Well, I think that there's a lot of, part of it is about inventing this alternative structures that foster mm-hmm. the better, more healthy habits. And we do know that the industrial food system is not based on promoting good health. It's about selling product, which is why so much processed foods that we have little relation to something that actually grew in the ground at one time, why that doesn't exist so much. So I think that's precisely why authors like Michael Pollan and the local food people have gotten so much traction, because people want to reclaim what they put inside their bodies and make sure that it has a certain purity and health to it. So it's a matter, I think, of promoting these alternative infrastructures and social systems that are more constructive or at least benign than the ones that we have. And that means decentralizing the authority, making them work more locally in ways that are therefore more responsive and accountable than the massive global food industry is. So the commons is basically then about decentralizing and empowering for local self-determination. And that's what I think is really the common thread in many commons-related enterprises.
Now, give our listeners, and I'm very curious about this too, a little bit of a handle on what's going on in Western Massachusetts in terms of, you know, a kind of piloting community for some of the principles that we're talking about.
Well, one of the more fascinating movements that you really don't hear much about is the Transition Town movement. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's many. It started in Ireland and Great Britain, where people said, you know, we're going to reach so-called peak oil soon, the point at which most of the oil in the earth will have been depleted and it will be a downward slide of production ever since, ever after. And we're also going to be approaching climate change problems very soon. And people in this Transition Town movement said, I'm too small as an individual to do much, but I know government is not going to take a leadership or action, and so I'm going to organize my community to become more economically self-reliant and stable going into these two crises. And so there's now dozens, if not hundreds, of such Transition Town communities around the world, but especially in Great Britain and increasingly in the United States, that are trying to reimagine their local community economies in anticipation of climate change disasters and peak oil. That's really one fascinating development, which is still in a very early stage, but it shows the kind of imagination and initiative that are going on.
Can you give some examples of how Transition Town is, you know, initiating new approaches in your region?
Well, I'm not as familiar with all of them locally. I know that there's, for example, a Transition Town Montague, a Transition Town Northampton, and so forth. And essentially what I like about them is that they're very open to all people participating. They're not a ideologically or politically driven thing. Are you a person of goodwill, talent, and energy? You're welcome to join us. And that's how they work. And they're also very practically oriented towards new systems that work. Be it waste disposal or food, you know, agriculture and food distribution. And so, it has this kind of optimistic can-do ethic, even though it has been, occasioned by some serious and rather grim crises, that are impending on us. So that's one really, exciting community-based thing that's going on, but there are a lot of other things, such as you may have heard of the solidarity economy movement or the, if you can imagine, the degrowth movement, both of which are quite active in Europe. And there's also another really local phenomena going on is the so-called maker movement, which consists of hacker spaces and 3D printing spaces and so-called fab labs where digital people will get together to create new things, sort of open source style, but in a physical space, often called, and these are sometimes called co-working spaces as well. And it's kind of a different way of meeting needs locally without the typical market apparatus of modern industrial society. It's really kind of a fascinating development.
Can you tell us a little bit about your other current book, Green Governance, Ecological Survival, Human Rights, and the Commons? What is that about?
Well, and the Law of the Commons. And it's a book I co-authored with an international human rights scholar, Burns Weston, at the University of Iowa. And we wanted to bring together in a book what we consider the law of the commons that goes back sometimes centuries, which has been eclipsed by market-based law over the past 150, 200 years. People don't realize that the Magna Carta in the 12th century was designed to protect commoners' rights, to give them access to the forest, which was they needed for their basic subsistence. But so you had a right to go into the forest to gather wood, or your pigs could eat acorns, or you could use the water nearby and so forth. Well, this was the basis for a lot of protection, legal protections for ordinary people for centuries. But when the market culture took over, you no longer had a right of subsistence anymore. If you didn't have the money, you couldn't buy food, you couldn't buy shelter, you couldn't buy water. So we wanted to identify and recover many fragments of law from the Roman era and, as I say, the Magna Carta and other times that embody commons-based principles for subsistence and survival, and to regard this as something that should be a human right, because what could be more a basic human right than the right to survive and have basic needs met? So this is a legal treatise that reimagines how law and public policy could be designed to protect commoners' rights and advance the creation and maintenance of ecological commons going forward. Because we see the commons as a way to start to set limits on consumption and growth, which are chewing up the earth. And so we wanted to find a way that conventional law might begin to support the creation and maintenance of commons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, that's fascinating.
This gets back to, let me give you an example. In Africa, there's all these communities that have for generations lived on their land and sustained themselves through it. But increasingly, you have foreign investors and even sovereign investment funds from governments like Saudi Arabia, South Korea, and others who are going into Africa, working with corrupt governments, and, quote, buying the land and evicting all the people who have lived there for generations in forests and savannas and other lands, maintaining themselves. Well, this is kind of an eerie replay of the English enclosure movement of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, where industrial people came in, took over commons, and evicted the commoners. And we're seeing it again, the dispossession of people in order to impose investment and market goals in a region. So if people could have rights to commons, the commoning as a verb, and therefore meet their basic needs, they would not only prevent a lot of the environmental abuse that investment and markets often impose upon lands, they would be able to have their culture and communities intact and have their basic needs met. But as I say, because this doesn't involve market activity, most economists and conventional policy and international trade doesn't recognize it as even valuable. In the standard economics textbooks today, the word commons is not mentioned except as the so-called tragedy of the commons, which we haven't mentioned yet, but this is a famous parable that got its start in the late 1960s. The idea was that no individual has a rational incentive to hold back from exploiting a shared resource, and this eventually results in the resource being overexploited and ruined. Mm. But it turns out that that's mostly a parable, because in actual practice, all sorts of commons are successfully sustained for many years, if not generations. It's quite possible that frequent for commons to be sustainable and not result in a tragedy, but economists can't quite see it that way because they have a whole different set of values and priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our goal in the book Green Governance. was to try to validate, imagine and validate a body of law to protect commons going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems very worthwhile. Even by defining it, you know, it can be not only brought into the legal system, but people can be aware of what they're losing. I mean, what you were describing about enclosure and people being dispossessed is exactly what's happening in excavation communities. I mean, basically, you know, no one forces you to leave, but the, you know, home value is lost, and you know, if the land is polluted and the banks won't mortgage a property after these excavation industries come in. And so this is going on in the United States right now, actually.
Well, the idea of, we haven't talked much about the concept of enclosure, but it's a very important term because mm-hmm. it describes what happens when markets privatize, commodify, marketize certain resources that historically have belonged to everyone. And mm-hmm. enclosures really are an act of dispossession and violation. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about fracking. That's really an act of enclosure because it's just coming in for what has economic value, grabbing it and running, and mm-hmm. letting all the associated costs, short and long term, be borne by the commoners or by governments. Mm-hmm. And so to have the very concept and vocabulary of enclosure mm-hmm. starts to open up a new kind of dialogue, because mm-hmm. this is a systemic phenomena.
Right.
It's not, you know, it happened in many, many different arenas.
And right.
The surprise is that the many victims of enclosure, be it auto accidents or fracking communities or, you know, people on the internet who don't have rights because of excessive copyright law, mm-hmm. there's a lot of commonalities among these seemingly disparate communities in the sense that market values have taken over their rights and dispossessed mm-hmm. them. So that's why talking about the commons and enclosure is valuable, because it gives us a vocabulary for talking about these cross-domain systemic phenomena.
Yes, and for also creating alliances with other communities.
Absolutely.
Yep. So that it's not just, you're not just speaking to your own community. I think that's really, really important. We're getting down to the last minutes of our show, and so we're going to, you know, be kind of ending shortly. But before we go out, I just want to urge our listeners to go to your website, Bollier, Bollier.org, and the book is Think Like a Commoner by David Bollier, A Short Introduction to the Life of the Commons. You'll find a lot of other great content about this topic there. Thank you so much for being with us this week, David, on Connect the Dots. Very interesting.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Allison.
And I want to thank you, our listeners, too, for being with us this week for another edition of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Check out our archives and check out my current blog on Alternet on some contamination issues. And we'll be back with you next Wednesday. Have a great week.